Allocating funds via peer review. Aubrey de Grey, gerontologist, chief science officer, SENS Foundation, author, Ending Aging. From top to bottom of the profession, scientists are forsaking their chosen vocation in greater numbers than ever before, in favor of a more dependable and less stressful source of income. What is the basis of this stress and uncertainty, which so severely depletes the ranks of that indispensable community who seek to further humanity's understanding of nature and thereby our ability to manipulate nature for the greater good? At the sharp end, it's the members of those ranks, scientists themselves, via the convention of apportioning funding by peer review of grant applications. Only at the sharp end, of course. I certainly don't lay blame at scientists' feet. In fact, I don't really lay blame anywhere. The issue is that the prevailing system evolved in a different time and in circumstances to which it was well suited, but has signally failed to adapt, indeed has shown itself intrinsically non-adaptable, to present conditions. What's needed is a replacement system that solves the problems everyone in science agrees exist today, but still distributes funds according to metrics that all constituencies agree is fair. The peer review system is apparently a local maximum. Numerous tweaks have been proposed, but all have resisted adoption because they do more harm than good. But is it a global maximum? Is it, as Churchill described democracy, the worst option except for all the others? Or could a radical departure rank higher by all key measures? Here I sketch a possible option. I'm not sure it ticks all the boxes, but it shows sufficient promise as a candidate that the scientific community need no longer bear with the current system on the assumption that nothing better is possible. First, briefly, what's so wrong with peer review of grant applications these days? Two words. Payline. Peer review evolved when the balance between supply of and demand for public research funds was such that at least 30% of applications could be funded. It worked well. If you didn't really know how to design a project, or how to communicate its value to your colleagues, or how to perform it economically, these failings would emerge, and you'd learn how to avoid them, until eventually those colleagues would recommend to the government that you be given your chance. But these days, the corresponding percentage is typically in single digits. Does that mean you just have to be really good? I wish. What it actually means is that you have to be not only really good, but also really persistent, and moreover, and this is by far the worst aspect, really, really convincing in your argument that the project will succeed. What's so bad about that? Simply that some projects are much easier than others, and the hard ones tend to be those that determine the long-term rate of progress of a discipline, even though they have a significant failure rate. A system that neglects high-risk, high-gain work hugely slows scientific progress, with catastrophic consequences for humanity. Cross-disciplinary research, work drawing together ideas not previously combined, which historically has also been exceptionally fruitful, is almost impossible to get funded, simply because no research panel, study section, in NIH vernacular, has the necessary range of expertise to understand the proposal's full value. All this would be largely solved by a system based on peer recognition rather than peer review. When a scientist first applies for public research funds, his or her career will be divided into 5-year periods, starting with the past 5 years, period zero, the coming 5, period one, and so on. Period one is funded at a low entry-level rate on the basis of simple qualifications: possession of a doctorate, number of years of postdoctoral study, etc., and without the researcher having provided any description of what specific research is to be undertaken. Period 2's funding level is determined as a percentage of total funds available for the scientist's chosen discipline, again, without any description of work to be performed, but instead on the basis of how well cited was the work performed in Period 0. This decision is made at the end of Period 1, Year 4, based on all citations since Period 0, Year 2. So a total of 8 years, to papers published in Period 0, Year 2, through Period 1, Year 1. 5 years, approximating the interval when work done during Period 0 will have been published. Citations are weighted according to whether the applicant is a first, senior, middle author. Self-citations aren't counted. Only papers reporting new research that depended on research funds are counted. Consideration is given to seniority and level of funding during the relevant period, according to a formula applied across the board rather than by discretion. Funding for Period 3 is determined similarly, at the end of Period 2, Year 4, on the basis of work performed during Period 1, and so on. Flexibility is incorporated concerning front-loading of funds to Year 1 of a given period to allow for large capital expenditures. This scheme improves on the current system in many ways. Zero time is spent preparing and submitting and resubmitting descriptions of proposed research, and zero money is spent on evaluating such proposals. Bias against high-risk, high-gain work is greatly reduced, both by the absence of peer review and also because funding periods exceed the currently typical 3 years. Significance of past work is evaluated after an appropriate period of time, not by such first impression measures as the impact factor of journals where one is just published. One can also split one's application across multiple disciplines, with funding level from each discipline proportioned accordingly, removing the bias against cross-disciplinary research. Finally, one has a year at the end of a period to plan what work will be done in the next period, in full knowledge of what resources will be at one's disposal. Researchers are, of course, free to seek additional funds from elsewhere, and indeed, some public funds could still be apportioned via the traditional method. This option need not represent a particularly radical departure. It could easily be phased in. Worth considering?
Some questions are too hard for young scientists to tackle. Ross Anderson, Professor of Security Engineering, Cambridge University, author, Security Engineering. Max Planck famously described the progress of science as being one funeral at a time, as the old school physicists died off and their jobs were taken by young men who followed the new quantum religion. This brutal style of scientific revolution has left some rather rigid scar tissue. For many years, it has been almost taboo to suggest that the questions at the foundations of quantum mechanics might actually have an answer. Yet new results in different areas of physics, chemistry, and engineering are beginning to suggest that there might possibly be an answer after all. At the Solvay conference in 1927, Niels Bohr and Werner Heisenberg out-debated Albert Einstein and Louis de Broglie. They persuaded the world that we should just take the tools of the new quantum mechanics on faith, rather than trying to derive them from underlying classical principles. This Copenhagen school, the shut-up-and-calculate school of quantum mechanics, rapidly became the orthodoxy. It was reinforced when calculations by John Bell were experimentally verified by Alain Aspect in 1982 and appeared to show that reality at the quantum level could not be both local and causal. While some philosophers of physics toyed with exotic interpretations of quantum mechanics, most physicists shrugged. They accepted quantum foundations as a certified insoluble problem and told their graduate students not to even think about wasting their lives on looking for a solution. Others just loved the idea that physics proves the world is too complex to understand and that the proof is beyond the comprehension of outsiders. Physicists could be the new high priests as the quantum became the core magic. Recently, we've got quantum with everything, from cryptography to biology. The word has become a magic spell for fundraising. So long as no one dared challenge this for fear of being thought a crank or dismissed as an outsider, we were stuck. Things are starting to change. In physics, Yves Couder and Emmanuel Fort found that bouncing droplets on a bath of vibrating oil mimic many phenomena previously thought unique to the quantum world, including single-slit and double-slit refraction, tunneling, and quantized energy levels. In chemistry, Masanao Ozawa and Werner Hofer have shown that the uncertainty principle is only approximately true. Modern scanning probe microscopes can often measure the position and momentum of atoms slightly more accurately than Heisenberg predicted, which should worry people who claim that quantum cryptography is provably secure. In computing, the promised quantum computers are still stuck at factoring 15, despite hundreds of millions in research funding over almost 20 years. And the physicist Theo von Neuvenhuysen has pointed out a contextuality loophole in Bell's theorem that looks rather hard to fix. There's a striking parallel with another big problem in science, consciousness. For years, the few first-division academics who dared tackle such problems tended to be near retirement and famous enough to shrug off disapproval. Just as Daniel Dennett and Nicholas Humphrey wrote on consciousness, Tony Leggett and Gerhard Hooft wrote on quantum foundations, so the flame was kept alight. But it's time to bring some tinder. Viennese physicists have now organized two symposia on emergent quantum mechanics as people finally dare to wrestle with what might be going on down there. So the idea I'd like to retire is the idea that some questions are just too big for normal working scientists to tackle. Old-timers should not try to erect taboos around problems that have eluded us. We must cheerfully challenge the young, prove us wrong. As for young scientists, they should dare to dream and to aim high.
Only scientists can do science. Kate Mills, doctoral student, Institute of Cognitive Neuroscience, University College, London. Currently, most individuals funded or employed to conduct scientific experiments have been trained in traditional academic settings. This includes not only the 12 years of compulsory education, but also another 6 to 10 years of university education, often followed by years of postdoctoral training. While this formal academic training undoubtedly equips one with the tools and resources to become a successful scientist, informally trained individuals of all ages are just as able to contribute to our knowledge of the world through science. These citizen scientists are often lauded for lightening the load on academic researchers engaged in big data projects. Citizen scientists have contributed to these projects by identifying galaxies or tracing neural processes, and typically without traditional incentives or rewards like payment or authorship. However, limiting the potential contributions of informally trained individuals to data collecting or data processing discounts the abilities of citizen scientists to inform study design, data analysis, and interpretation. Soliciting the opinions of individuals who are participants in scientific studies, that is, children, patients, can help traditional scientists design ecologically valid and engaging studies. Equally, these populations might have their own scientific questions or provide new and diverse perspectives to the interpretation of results. Importantly, science is not limited to adults. Children as young as 8 have co-authored scientific reports. Teenagers have made important health discoveries with tangible outcomes. Unfortunately, these young scientists face many obstacles that institutionally funded individuals often take for granted, such as access to previously published scientific findings. While the rise of open access publication, as well as many open science initiatives, make the scientific environment friendlier for citizen scientists, many traditional science practices remain out of reach for those without sufficient funds. What we think we know about ourselves through science could be skewed, since the majority of psychology studies sample individuals who don't represent the population as a whole. These weird, Western, educated, industrialized, rich, democratic samples make up most non-clinical neuroimaging studies as well. Increased awareness of this bias has prompted researchers to actively seek out samples that are more representative. However, there's less discussion or awareness of the potential biases introduced by weird scientists. If most funded and published scientific research is conducted by a sample of individuals trained to be successful in academia, then we're potentially biasing scientific questions and interpretations. Individuals who might not fit into an academic mold, but nevertheless are curious to know the world through the scientific method, face many barriers. Crowd-funded projects, and even scientists, are beginning to receive recognition from fellow scientists dependent on dwindling numbers of grants and academic positions. However, certain scientific experiments are more difficult, if not impossible, to conduct without institutional support. For example, studies involving human participants. Community-supported checks and balances remain essential for scientific projects, but perhaps they, too, can become unbound from traditional academic settings. The means for collecting and analyzing data are becoming more accessible to the public each day. New ethical issues will need to be discussed and infrastructures built to accommodate those conducting research outside traditional settings. With this, we will see an increase in the number of scientific discoveries made by informally trained citizen scientists of all ages and backgrounds. Those previously unheard voices will add valuable contributions to our knowledge of the world. The Scientific Method. Melanie Swan, Systems Level Thinker, Futurist, Applied Genomics Expert, Principal, MS Futures Group, Founder, DIY Genomics. The scientific idea most ready for retirement is the scientific method itself. More precisely, it's the idea that there's only one scientific method, one exclusive way of obtaining scientific results. The traditional scientific method, as an exclusive approach, is not adequate to the new situations of contemporary science like big data, crowdsourcing, and synthetic biology. Hypothesis testing through observation, measurement, and experimentation made sense in the past when obtaining information was scarce and costly, but this is no longer the case. In recent decades, we've been adapting to a new era of information abundance that has facilitated experimental design and iteration. One result is that there's now a field of computational science alongside nearly every discipline. For example, computational biology and digital manuscript archiving. Information abundance and computational advance have promulgated the evolution of a scientific model distinct from the traditional scientific method, and three emerging areas are advancing it even more. Big data, the creation and use of large and complex cloud-based data sets, is one pervasive trend reshaping the conduct of science. The scale is immense. Organizations routinely process millions of transactions per hour into 100 petabyte databases. Worldwide annual data creation is currently doubling and estimated to reach 8 zettabytes in 2015. Even before the big data era, modeling, simulating, and predicting became a key computational step in the scientific process, and the new methods required to work with big data make the traditional scientific method increasingly less relevant. Our relationship to information has changed with big data. Previously, in the era of information scarcity, all data was salient. In a calendar, for example, every data element or appointment is important and intended for action. With big data, the opposite is true. 99% of the data may be irrelevant, immediately, over time, or once processed into higher resolution. The focus becomes extracting points of relevance from an expansive whole, looking for signal from noise, anomalies, and exceptions, for example, genomic polymorphisms. The next level of big data processing is pattern recognition. High sampling frequencies allow not only point testing of phenomena, as in the traditional scientific method, but its full elucidation over multiple time frames and conditions. For the first time, we can obtain longitudinal baseline norms, variance, patterns, and cyclical behavior. This requires thinking beyond the simple causality of the traditional scientific method into extended systemic models of correlation, association, and episode triggering. Some of the prominent methods used in big data discovery include machine learning algorithms, neural networks, hierarchical representation, and information visualization. Crowdsourcing is another trend reshaping the conduct of science. This is the coordination of large numbers of individuals, the crowd, through the Internet to participate in some activity. Crowd models have led to the development of a science ecosystem that includes the professionally trained institutional researcher using the traditional scientific method at one end and the citizen scientist exploring issues of personal interest through a variety of methods at the other. In between are different levels of professionally organized and peer-coordinated efforts. The Internet and the trend to Internet connect all people, 2 billion, now estimated to be 5 billion in 2020, enables very large-scale science. Not only are existing studies cheaper and quicker in crowdsourced cohorts, but studies 100 times the size and detail of previous studies are now possible. The crowd can provide volumes of data by automatically linking quantified self-tracking gadgets to Data Commons websites. Citizen scientists participate in light information processing and other data collection and analysis activities through websites like Galaxy Zoo. The crowd is engaged more extensively through crowdsourced labor marketplaces, initially like Mechanical Turk, now increasingly skill-targeted, data competitions, and serious gaming, like predicting protein folding and RNA conformation. New methods for the conduct of science are being innovated through DIY efforts, the quantified self, biohacking, 3D printing, and collaborative peer-based studies. Synthetic biology is a third widespread trend reshaping the conduct of science. Lauded as the potential transistor of the 21st century, given its transformative possibilities, synthetic biology is the design and construction of biological devices and systems. It's highly multidisciplinary, linking biology, engineering, functional design, and computation. One of the key application areas is metabolic engineering, working with cells to expand their usual production of substances, which can then be used for energy, agriculture, and pharmaceutical purposes. The nature of synthetic biology is proactively creating de novo biological systems, organisms, and capacities, which is the opposite of the passive characterization of phenomena for which the original scientific method was developed. While it's true that optimizing genetic and regulatory processes within cells can be partially construed under the scientific method, the overall scope of activity and methods are much broader. Innovating de novo organisms and functionality requires a significantly different scientific methodology than that supported by the traditional scientific method, and includes a reconceptualization of science as an endeavor of characterizing and creating. We can no longer rely exclusively on the traditional scientific method in the new era of science emerging in areas like big data, crowdsourcing, and synthetic biology. Many models should be employed for the next generation of scientific advance, supplementing the traditional scientific method with new ways that are better suited and equally valid, and opening up new tiers for the conduct of science. Science can now be carried out downstream at increasingly detailed levels of resolution and permutation, and upstream with broader systemic dynamism. Temporality and the future become more knowable and predictable as all processes, human and otherwise, can be modeled with continuous real-time updates. Epistemologically, how we know and the truth of the world and reality is changing. In some sense, we may be in an intermediate Dark Ages node, where the multiplicity of future science methods can pull us into a new enlightenment just as surely as the traditional scientific method pulled us into modernity.
Big effects have big explanations. Ferry Cushman, Assistant Professor of Psychology, Harvard University. Many scientists are seduced by a two-step path to success. First, identify a big effect, and then find the explanation for it. There's an implicit theory behind this approach, which is that big effects have big explanations. And scientists are more interested in the explanations than in the effects. Newton is famous not for showing that apples and orbiting bodies both fall, but for explaining why. So if the implicit theory is wrong, then a lot of people are barking up the wrong trees. There is, of course, an alternative and plausible source of big effects, many small explanations interacting. As it happens, this alternative is worse than the wrong tree. It's a near hopeless tree. The wrong tree would simply yield a disappointingly small explanation, but the hopeless tree has so many explanations tangled in knotted branches that extraordinary effort is required to obtain any fruit at all. So, do big effects tend to have big explanations or many explanations? There's probably no single, simple, and uniformly correct answer to this question. It's a hopeless tree. But we can use a simple model to make an educated guess. Suppose the world is composed of three kinds of things. There are levers we can pull. Pulling these levers cause observable effects. Lights flash, bells ring, apples fall. Finally, there's a hidden layer of causal forces, the explanations, that connect the levers to their effects. In order to explore this toy world, I simulated it on my laptop. First, I created 1,000 levers. Each lever activated from 1 to 5 hidden mechanisms. 200 levers activated just one mechanism each, another 200 activated 2, and so on. In my simulation, each mechanism was simply a number drawn from a normal distribution with a mean of 0. Then the hidden mechanisms activated by each lever were summed to produce an observable effect. So 200 of the levers produced effects equal to a single number drawn from a normal distribution. Another 200 levers produced effects equal to the sum of 2 such numbers, and so forth. After this, I had a list of 1,000 effects of varying size. Some were large, very negative or very positive. Others were small, close to zero. I looked at the 50 smallest effects, curious to see how many of them resulted from a single, isolated mechanism. 11 out of 50. Then I checked how many were the result of 5 mechanisms added together. 6 out of 50. The smallest effects tended to have fewer explanations. Next, I looked at the 50 largest effects, about 100 times larger on average, and found that they tended to have many more explanations. 25 of them had 5 explanations. Not one had a single explanation. The first such single explanation effect was ranked 103rd in size. These examples help make my point tangible, but its essence can be captured more succinctly. The standard deviation of the sum of 2 uncorrelated random variables is greater than the standard deviation of either individually. So, if a scientist's exclusive goal was simplicity, then in my toy world, she ought to avoid the very biggest effects and instead pursue the smallest ones. Yet she might feel cheated because this method would identify only explanations of little influence. As a crude method of balancing simplicity, few explanations, against influence, big explanations, I computed a sort of expected value of experimentation for different effect sizes, the probability of finding a one-cause effect multiplied by the size of the effect in question. As you might guess, the highest expected values tend to fall toward the middle of the range of effect sizes. Balance, it seems, finds a soulmate in modesty. Now, there are some caveats to my back-of-the-envelope calculations. Most scientists are capable of working out causal mechanisms that have more than one dimension. Some can even handle 5. Also, the actual causal mechanisms that scientists investigate are far more complicated than my model allows for. One explanation may be related to many effects. Multiple explanations combine with each other non-linearly. Explanations may be correlated, and so forth. Still, it's worth retiring the implicit theory that we should most doggedly pursue the largest effects. I suspect that every scientist has a favorite example of the perils of this theory. In my field, lakes of ink have been why people consider it acceptable to redirect a speeding trolley away from 5 people and toward 1, but unacceptable to hurl 1 person in front of a trolley in order to stop it from hitting 5. This case is alluring because the effect is huge and its explanation is not at all obvious. After years of research across many labs, however, there's considerable agreement that the effect doesn't have just one explanation. In fact, we've tended to learn more from studying much smaller effects with a key benefit, a sole cause. It's natural to praise research that delivers large effects and the theories that purport to explain them. And this praise is often justified, not least because the world has large problems demanding ambitious scientific solutions. Yet science can advance only at the rate of its best explanations. Often the most elegant arise from effects of modest proportions. Science equals big science. Samuel Arbesman, applied mathematician, senior scholar, research and policy, Ewing Marion Kauffman Foundation. Author, The Half-Life of Facts. Centuries ago, when science was young, it was possible to make contributions to scientific knowledge through simple experiments. You could be a hobbyist or a gentleman scientist and discover something fundamental about the world around us. But in the past several decades, science has gotten bigger. In this era of big science, we need large teams of scientists working together to make discoveries in everything from the life sciences to high-energy physics. And we need lots of money to do this. The era of the lone scientist doing small-scale science seems to be over. And that's often the narrative we hear. The Higgs boson wasn't discovered using an apparatus developed in a garage. It was found using a massive technological construction, and thousands of scientists were involved. So, is small-scale science over? Although the trend is clearly toward team science, small and clever science, the realm of the tiny budget, the elegant experiment, sometimes even the hobbyist, is by no means defunct. Small science is not necessarily the lone underdog working against the establishment. More often, it's simply one or two underfunded scientists doing their best. But it seems they survive, even in this modern era of big science. Several years ago, for example, a paleontology graduate student cleared a dinosaur of cannibalism charges, a discovery that began with a very simple observation. By looking at one of the fossil casts on the wall of the American Museum of Natural History's subway station. Or consider the scientists who examined the space of possible ways to tie a necktie and whose research was published in Nature. Little science is still possible. Though these examples might be somewhat trivial, small-scale science can have a big impact. Peter Mitchell was awarded the 1978 Nobel Prize in Chemistry for work he conducted at his own small private research institute with only a handful of people. Support for this lab included funds from his family, making Mitchell a modern-day equivalent of the gentleman scientist. Another Nobel Prize was awarded for work on split-brain patients, those with the connection between their two hemispheres severed, which led to novel insights into the brain's function. Part of this work consisted of experiments so simple, though exceedingly clever, that the Nobel website features a game just like the original experiments, which you can play at home. You can still do science on the cheap. Several decades ago, Stanley Milgram measured the well-known 6 degrees of separation using little more than postcards. While science has become bigger since then, in some ways it has become even easier to conduct large-scale science by operating at a small scale. Thanks to huge computational advances and widespread data freely available, not to mention easier data collection online, any scientist can do big science cheaply today and in a small and easy way. Technology allows research scientists to leverage tiny budgets in astonishing ways, and each of us can now easily contribute to science as an amateur through the growing prevalence of citizen science, in which the general public helps, often in a small, incremental way, in such tasks as data collection. From categorizing galaxies or plankton to figuring out how proteins fold, everyone can now be a part of the scientific process. And although mathematics might still be the domain of the singular genius, it too has a place for the hobbyist or amateur. In the mid-1990s, two high school students discovered a novel additional solution to a problem that Euclid posed and solved thousands of years ago, and for which no other method had been found since. There's even an entire domain known as recreational mathematics. What these examples demonstrate is that creative experiments and the right questions are as important as ample funding and infrastructure, and that technology is making this work easier than ever. Little science can still prosper.
Sadness is always bad. Happiness is always good. June Gruber, Assistant Professor of Psychology, Director, Positive Emotion and Psychopathology Laboratory, University of Colorado, Boulder. One idea in the study of emotion and its effect on psychological health is overdue for retirement, that negative emotions, like sadness or fear, are inherently bad or maladaptive for our psychological well-being, whereas positive emotions, like happiness or joy, are inherently good or adaptive. Such value judgments are to be understood within the framework of adaptive science as depending on whether an emotion impedes or fosters a person's ability to pursue goals, attain resources, and function effectively within society. Claims such as sadness is inherently bad or happiness is inherently good must be abandoned in light of advances in the scientific study of human emotion. Let's start with negative emotions. Early hedonic theories defined well-being, in part, as the relative absence of negative emotion. Empirically based treatments like cognitive behavioral therapy also focus on the reduction of negative feelings and moods as part of enhancing well-being. Yet a strong body of scientific work suggests that negative emotions are essential to our psychological well-being. Here are three examples. 1. From an evolutionary perspective, negative emotions aid in our survival by providing important clues to threats or problems needing our attention, such as an unhealthy relationship or a dangerous situation. 2. Negative emotions help us focus. They facilitate detailed and analytic thinking, reduce stereotypic thinking, enhance eyewitness memory, and promote persistence in challenging cognitive tasks. 3. Attempting to suppress negative emotions, rather than accepting and appreciating them, paradoxically backfires. It increases feelings of distress and intensifies clinical symptoms of substance abuse, overeating, and even suicidal ideation. Counter to these hedonic theories of well-being, negative emotions are thus not inherently bad for us. Moreover, their relative absence predicts poorer psychological adjustment. Positive emotions are seen as pleasant or positively valent states motivating us to pursue goal-directed behavior. A long-standing scientific tradition has focused on the benefits of positive emotions, cognitive benefits such as enhanced creativity, social benefits like relationship satisfaction and pro-social behavior, and physical benefits such as enhanced cardiovascular health. From this work has emerged the assumption that positive emotional states should always be maximized, fueling the birth of entire sub-disciplines and garnering much popular attention. But there's a mounting body of work against the claim that positive emotions are inherently good. 1. They foster self-focused behavior, including selfishness, stereotyping of out-group members, cheating and dishonesty, and decreased empathic accuracy in some contexts. 2. They're associated with greater distractibility and impaired performance on detail-oriented cognitive tasks. 3. Because they may reduce inhibitions, they're associated with risk-taking and higher mortality rates. Indeed, positive emotions aren't always adaptive and sometimes impede our well-being and even our survival. Valence is not value. We cannot infer value judgments about emotions based on their positive or negative valence. There's no intrinsic goodness or badness of an emotion merely because of its positivity or negativity. Instead, we must refine specific value-based determinants for an emotion's functionality. To this end, new research highlights critical variables to focus on. Importantly, the context in which an emotion unfolds can determine whether it helps or hinders an individual's goal, and which types of emotion regulatory strategies, reappraising or distracting, will best match the situation. Moreover, the degree of one's psychological flexibility, including how quickly one can shift emotions or rebound from a stressful situation, promotes critical health outcomes. Psychological well-being is not determined by the presence of one type of emotion, but by a diversity of emotions, both positive and negative. Whether or not an emotion is good or bad seems to have surprisingly little to do with the emotion itself, but rather with how mindfully we ride the ebbing and flowing tides of our rich emotional life.
Opposites can't both be right. Eldar Shafir, William Stewart Todd, Professor of Psychology and Public Affairs, Princeton University, co-author, with Sandhil Mullanathan, Scarcity. British chef Heston Blumenthal's imaginative hot and iced tea is a syrupy concoction prepared by putting a divider down the middle of a glass, then filling one side with a hot tea and the other with an iced version. Because of the viscous consistency of the liquid, when the divider is removed, the two halves stay separate long enough for the lucky diner to simultaneously sample perfectly hot and iced tea. When you sip Blumenthal's tea, it makes no sense to argue about whether it's cold or hot. You could, of course, take care to sip only from the cold side or only from the hot, but the glass of tea is both. Much of the world and the sciences, certainly the social and behavioral sciences, look more like that glass of tea than we often let on. We typically assume, for example, that happiness and sadness are polar opposites and thus mutually exclusive. But recent research on emotion suggests that positive and negative affects should not be thought of as existing on opposite sides of a continuum, and that, in fact, feelings of happiness and sadness can co-occur. When study participants were surveyed immediately after watching certain films or after graduating from college, they were found to feel both profoundly happy and sad. Our emotional experience, it turns out, is a lot like a glass of viscous tea. It can run hot and cold at the same time. The same can be true of good and evil. Like sipping from the hot or the cold side of the glass, we now know that minor contextual nuance can make all the difference. In one classic study, psychologists J.M. Darley and C.D. Batson recruited seminary students to deliver a sermon on the parable of the Good Samaritan. While half the seminarians were told they were comfortably ahead of the scheduled time for the talk, others were led to believe they were running late. On their way to give the talk, all participants encountered an ostensibly injured man slumped in a doorway, groaning and needing help. Most of those with time to spare stopped to help, but a mere 10% of those who were running late stopped, the rest stepping over the victim and rushing on. Notwithstanding their ethical training and biblical scholarship, the minor nuance of a time constraint proved critical to the seminarian's decision to ignore the pleas of a suffering man. Like that high-concept glass of tea, each seminarian was both caring and indifferent, displaying one trait or the other, depending on an arbitrary twist of fate. Or consider John Rabe, the bald and bespectacled German engineer known as the Living Buddha of Nanking. Rabe was the legendary head of the International Committee for the Nanking Safety Zone. He was credited with having saved hundreds of thousands of Chinese lives during the savage Japanese occupation. On the other side of the glass, Rabe was simultaneously the leader of the Nazi Party in the same city. In 1938, he assured audiences that he supported the German political system 100%. In its essence, this sort of anti-Manichaean perspective posits that not only one alternative always obtains. If you believe that people are only always good or always evil, if you think the glass is only either hot or cold, well, you're just wrong. You haven't felt the glass, and you have a terribly naive understanding of human nature. But as long as your views are not that extreme, as long as you recognize the possibility of both cold and hot, then in many cases you needn't choose. It turns out they're both there. From the little I understand, physicists question the classical distinction between wave and matter, and biologists refuse to choose between nature and nurture. But let me stay close to what I know best. In the social sciences, there's ongoing and often heated debate about whether or not people are rational and about whether or not they're selfish. And there are compelling studies in support of either camp, the hot and the iced. People can be cold, precise, selfish, and calculating. Or they can be hot-headed, confused, altruistic, emotional, and biased. In fact, they can exhibit these conflicting traits at the very same time. People can be perfectly calibrated weather forecasters, but hopelessly overconfident investors, ruthless rulers and cuddly pet owners, compassionate friends and apathetic parents. Research on decisions made in demanding contexts has found that people can be thoughtful and calculating as they focus on issues of immediate concern, but negligent and misguided when it comes to issues, sometimes closely related and equally or more important ones, at the periphery of their attention. As we all know, history is filled with smart people who did stupid things and good people who acted horribly. Are we altruistic or selfish, smart or stupid, good or evil? Like that hot and iced tea, there's always a little of both. It just depends on which side of the glass you drink from. People are sheep. David Barraby, journalist, blogger, MindMattersBigThink.com, author, Us and Them, The Science of Identity. In the late summer of 1914, as European civilization began its extended suicide, dissenters were scarce. On the contrary, from every major capital, we have newsreel footage of happy crowds cheering in the summer sunshine. More war and depression followed in subsequent decades, and there was never a shortage of willing executioners and obedient lackeys. By mid-century, the time of Stalin and Mao and their smaller bore imitators, it seemed urgent to understand why people throughout the 20th century had failed to rise up against masters who sent them to war, or to concentration camps, or to the Gulag. So social scientists came up with an answer, which was then consolidated and popularized into something every educated person supposedly knows. People are sheep. Cowardly, deplorable sheep. This idea, that most of us are unwilling to think for ourselves, instead preferring to stay out of trouble, obey the rules, and conform, was supposedly established by rigorous laboratory experiments. That we have found the tendency to conformity in our society so strong that reasonably intelligent and well-meaning young people are willing to call white black is a matter of concern, wrote the great psychologist Solomon Asch in 1955. Plenty of research papers still refer to one or another aspect of the sheep model as if it were a truth universally acknowledged and a sturdy rock on which to build new hypotheses about mass behavior. Worse yet, it's rampant in the conversation of educated laypeople, politicians, voters, government officials. Yet it's false. It makes for bad assumptions and bad policies. It's time to set it aside. Some years ago, the psychologists Bert Hodges and Anne Geyer examined one of Asch's experiments from the 1950s. He'd ask people to look at a line printed on a white card and then say which of three similar lines on another card was the same length. Each volunteer was part of a small group whose other members were actually collaborators in the study, deliberately picking wrong answers. Asch reported that when the group chose the wrong match, many individuals went along, against the evidence of their own senses. But the experiment actually involved 12 separate comparisons for each subject, and the subjects did not agree with the majority most of the time. In fact, on average, each subject agreed three times with the majority and insisted on his own view the nine other times. To make those results all about the evils of conformity is to say, as Hodges and Geyer note, that an individual's moral obligation in the situation is to call it as he sees it, without consideration of what others say. To explain their actions, the volunteer subjects didn't indicate that their senses had been warped or that they were terrified of going against consensus. Instead, they said they had chosen to go along that one time. It's not hard to see why a reasonable person would do so. The people are sheep model sets us up to think in terms of obedience or defiance, dumb conformity versus solitary self-assertion. To avoid being a sheep, you must be a lone wolf. It doesn't recognize that people need to place their trust in others and win the trust of others, and that this guides their behavior. Stanley Milgram's famous experiments, in which people were willing to give severe shocks to a supposed stranger, are often cited as Exhibit A for the people are sheep model. But what these studies really tested was the trust the subjects had in the experimenter. Indeed, questions about trust in others, how it's won and kept, who wins it and who doesn't, seem essential to understanding how collectives of people operate and affect their members. What else is at work? It appears that behavior is also susceptible to the sort of moment-by-moment influences once considered irrelevant noise. For example, seminary students in a rush were far less likely to help a stranger than were seminary students who weren't late in the experiment performed by John M. Darley and Dan Batson. And then there's mounting evidence of influences that discomfit psychologists because there doesn't seem to be much psychology in them at all. For example, Neil Johnson of the University of Miami and Michael Spaggett of Royal Holloway, University of London, and their colleagues have found the severity and timing of attacks in many different wars, different actors, different stakes, different cultures, different continents, adhere to a power law. If that's true, then an individual fighter's motivation, ideology, and beliefs make much less difference than we think for the decision to attack next Tuesday. Or, to take another example, if, as Nicholas Christakis' work suggests, your risks of smoking, getting a sexually transmitted disease, catching the flu, or being obese depend in part on your social network ties, then how much difference does it make what you, as an individual, feel or think? Perhaps the behavior of people in groups will eventually be explained as a combination of moment-to-moment influences, like waves on the sea, and powerful drivers that work outside of awareness, like deep ocean currents. All the open questions are important and fascinating, but they're visible only after we give up the simplistic notion that we're sheep. Beauty is in the eyes of the beholder. David M. Buss, Professor of Psychology, University of Texas, Austin. Author, The Dangerous Passion, Why Jealousy is as Necessary as Love and Sex. For most of the past century, mainstream social scientists have assumed that attractiveness is superficial, arbitrary, and infinitely variable across cultures. Many still cling to these views. Their appeal has many motivations. First, beauty is undemocratically distributed, a violation of the belief that we're all created equal. Second, if physical desirability is superficial, you can't judge a book by its cover, its importance can be dismissed, taking a back seat to deeper and more meaningful qualities. Third, if standards of beauty are arbitrary and infinitely variable, they can be easily changed. Two movements in the 20th century seemed to lend scientific support to these views. The first was behaviorism. If the content of human character was built through experienced contingencies of reinforcement during development, those contingencies must have created standards of attractiveness. The second was seemingly astonishing ethnographic discoveries of cross-cultural variability in attractiveness. If the Maori in New Zealand found particular types of lip tattoos attractive, and the Yanomami of the Amazon rainforest prized nose or cheek piercings, then surely all other beauty standards must be similarly arbitrary. The resurgence of sexual selection theory in evolutionary biology, and specifically the importance of preferential mate choice, created powerful reasons to question the theoretical position long held by social scientists. We now know that in species with preferential mate choice, from scorpion flies to peacocks to elephant seals, physical appearance typically matters greatly. It conveys critical, reproductively valuable qualities such as health, fertility, dominance, and good genes. Are humans a bizarre exception to all other sexually reproducing species? Evolutionary theorizing, long antedating the hundreds of empirical studies on the topic, suggested we were not. In mate selection, job one, as someone in business might say, is the successful selection of a fertile partner. Those who failed to find fertile mates left no descendants. Everyone alive today is the product of a long and unbroken line of ancestors who succeeded. As evolutionary success stories, each modern human has inherited the mate preferences of his or her successful ancestors. Cues recurrently observable to our ancestors, which were reliably, statistically, probabilistically correlated with fertility, according to this theory, should become part of our evolved standards of beauty. In both genders, these include cues to health, symmetrical features, and absence of sores and lesions, for example. Since fertility is sharply age-graded in women, more so than in men, cues to youth should figure prominently in gender-specific standards of attractiveness. Clear skin, full lips, an unclouded sclera, feminine estrogen-dependent features, a low waist-to-hip ratio, and many other cues to female fertility are now known to be pieces of the puzzle of universal standards of female beauty. Women's evolved standards of male attractiveness are more complex. Masculine features, hypothesized to signal healthy immune functioning in men, are viewed as attractive more by women seeking short-term rather than long-term mates, more when women are ovulating than when they're in the luteal phase of their menstrual cycle, and more by women who are higher in mate value, perhaps because of their ability to attract and control such men. Women's judgments of men's attractiveness are more dependent on multiple contexts, cues to social status, the attention structure, positive interactions with babies, being seen with attractive women, and many others. The greater complexity and variability of what women find attractive in men is reflected in another key empirical finding. There's far less consensus among women about which men are attractive than among men about which women are attractive. The theory that beauty is in the eye of the beholder, in the sense of being superficial, arbitrary, and infinitely culturally variable, can safely be discarded. I regard it as one of the great myths perpetrated by social scientists in the 20th century. Its scientific replacement, that beauty is in the adaptations of the beholder, as anthropologist Donald Simons phrases it, continues to be disturbing to some. It violates some of our most cherished beliefs and values. But then so did the notion that the earth was not flat or the center of the universe.
Romantic Love and Addiction. Helen Fisher, biological anthropologist, Rutgers University. Author, Why Him, Why Her? How to Find and Keep Lasting Love. If at first the idea is not absurd, then there is no hope for it, Albert Einstein reportedly said. I'd like to broaden the definition of addiction, and also retire the scientific idea that all addictions are pathological and harmful. Since the beginning of formal diagnostics, more than 50 years ago, the compulsive pursuit of gambling, food, and sex, known as non-substance rewards, have not been regarded as addictions. Only abuse of alcohol, opioids, cocaine, amphetamines, cannabis, heroin, and nicotine have been formally regarded as addictions. This categorization rests largely on the fact that substances activate basic reward pathways in the brain associated with craving and obsession and produce pathological behaviors. Psychiatrists work within this world of psychopathology, that which is abnormal and makes you ill. As an anthropologist, I think they're limited by this view. Scientists have now shown that food, sex, and gambling compulsions employ many of the same brain pathways activated by substance abuse. Indeed, the 2013 edition of the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual of Mental Disorders, the DSM, has finally acknowledged that at least one form of non-substance abuse, gambling, can be regarded as an addiction. The abuse of sex and food have not yet been included. Neither has romantic love. I shall propose that love addiction is just as real as any other addiction in terms of its behavior patterns and brain mechanisms. Moreover, it's often a positive addiction. Scientists and laymen have long regarded romantic love as part of the supernatural, or as a social invention of the troubadours in 12th century France. Evidence does not support these notions. Love songs, poems, stories, operas, ballets, novels, myths, and legends, love magic, love charms, love suicides and homicides, evidence of romantic love has now been found in more than 200 societies ranging over thousands of years. Around the world, men and women pine for love, live for love, kill for love, and die for love. Human romantic love, also known as passionate love or being in love, is regularly regarded as a human universal. Moreover, love-besotted men and women show all the basic symptoms of addiction. Foremost, the lover is stiletto-focused on his/her drug of choice, the love object. The lover thinks obsessively about him or her, intrusive thinking, and often compulsively calls, writes, or stays in touch. Paramount in this experience is intense motivation to win one's sweetheart, not unlike the substance abuser fixated on the drug. Impassioned lovers distort reality, change their priorities and daily habits to accommodate the beloved, experience personality changes, affect disturbance, and sometimes do inappropriate or risky things to impress this special other. Many are willing to sacrifice, even die for him or her. The lover craves emotional and physical union with the beloved, dependence. And like addicts who suffer when they can't get their drug, the lover suffers when apart from the beloved, separation anxiety. Adversity and social barriers even heighten this longing, frustration attraction. In fact, besotted lovers express all four of the basic traits of addiction: craving, tolerance, withdrawal, and relapse. They feel a rush of exhilaration when they're with their beloved, intoxication. As their tolerance builds, they seek to interact with the beloved more and more, intensification. If the love object breaks off the relationship, the lover experiences signs of drug withdrawal, including protest, crying spells, lethargy, anxiety, insomnia, or hypersomnia, loss of appetite, or binge eating, irritability, and loneliness. Lovers, like addicts, also often go to extremes, sometimes doing degrading or physically dangerous things to win back the beloved. And lovers relapse the way drug addicts do. Long after the relationship is over, events, people, places, songs, or other external cues associated with their abandoning sweetheart can trigger memories and renewed craving. Of the many indications that romantic love is an addiction, however, perhaps none is more convincing than the growing data from neuroscience. Using fMRI, several scientists have now shown that feelings of intense romantic love engage regions of the brain's reward system. Specifically, dopamine pathways associated with energy, focus, motivation, ecstasy, despair, and craving, including primary regions associated with substance and non-substance addictions. In fact, I and my colleagues, Lucy Brown, Art Aaron, and Bianca Acevedo, have found activity in the nucleus accumbens, the core brain factory associated with all addictions, in rejected lovers. Moreover, some of our newest results suggest correlations between activities of the nucleus accumbens and feelings of romantic passion among lovers who are wildly, happily in love. Nobel laureate Eric Kandel has noted that brain studies will give us new insights into who we are as human beings. Knowing what we know about the brain, my brain scanning partner, Lucy Brown, has suggested that romantic love is a natural addiction. And I've maintained that this natural addiction evolved from mammalian antecedents some 4.4 million years ago among our first hominid ancestors, in conjunction with the evolution of serial social monogamy, a hallmark of mankind. Its purpose? To motivate our forebears to focus their mating time and metabolic energy on a single partner at a time, thus initiating the formation of a pair bond to rear their young, at least through infancy, together as a team. The sooner we embrace what brain science is telling us and use this information to upgrade the concept of addiction, the better we'll understand ourselves and the billions of others on this planet who revel in the ecstasy and struggle with the sorrow of this profoundly powerful, natural, often positive addiction. Romantic love.
Emotion is peripheral. Brian Knutson, Associate Professor of Psychology and Neuroscience, Stanford University. Some still assume that emotion is peripheral, but the time has come to recognize that emotion is central. The claim that emotion is peripheral can be taken both literally and figuratively. From a literal standpoint, experts have argued since the birth of experimental psychology in the Gilded Age about which physiology is necessary for emotional experience. In his seminal essay, What is an Emotion?, William James counterintuitively claimed that when we encounter a bear, peripheral, that is, below the neck, physiological changes occur. The stomach clenches, the heart pounds, the skin sweats, which then generate an experience of emotion, fear. By implication, peripheral responses must occur before the feeling of fear. His Harvard colleague Walter Cannon disagreed, stating that brain activity causes both emotional experience and peripheral responses. Cannon based his argument on research. For example, emotional responses could be evoked by stimulating the brains of cats who continued to show those emotional responses after spinal cord lesions, as well as on physiological logic. Peripheral responses were too slow, insensitive, and undifferentiated to drive emotional experience. Thus, although James was a creative thinker and a persuasive writer, he reasoned from the armchair, whereas the stolid and understated Cannon, who also innovated influential concepts such as homeostasis and fight or flight, brought data to bear on the debate. I keep revisiting this century-old academic scuffle. That's because peripheralist assumptions still form the backbone of many modern emotion theories. For example, in the form of peripheral somatic signals, or embodiment, or indeed any sensory process purported to mediate emotion. Of course, peripheral responses can modulate emotion, but they're not fast or specific enough to mediate the kinds of rapid emotional responses that ensured our ancestors' survival. Emotion also undoubtedly generates peripheral responses, but without information about which came first, correlated action doesn't imply causal direction. To be fair to the peripheral view, scientists currently lack a quantitative computational model of exactly how the brain generates emotion, and the neural mechanisms are still being worked out. But as the next few years of brain stimulation, lesion, and imaging evidence accumulates, I'm betting that the central account of emotion will prevail. From a figurative standpoint, the problematical assumptions of emotional peripheralism run deeper. An even older debate focuses on emotion's function rather than structure. Specifically, is emotion peripheral or central to mental function? A peripheralist viewpoint might posit that emotion does not influence and even disrupts mental function. While the historical roots of such an assumption may reach back as far as Zoroastrian dualism, René Descartes typically gets the blame for importing dualism from the church to science. Descartes split the mind and passions by placing the mind with the spirit, but the passions with the body, where they took the form of animal spirits purported to move the pineal gland. According to Cartesian mind-body dualism, the mind could thus operate independently of the disruption of excessive passions. In contrast to this peripheralist vision, a depiction of the centrality of emotion to mental function comes not from the West, but from the East. The Tibetan Buddhist Wheel of Life represents passionate attachments as animals occupying the hub of a spinning wheel, driving thought and behavior. In both schemes, excessive passions can divert thought and action, but in Descartes' scheme, emotion disrupts the mind from the periphery, whereas in the Buddhist scheme, emotion drives the mind from the center. If emotion is central to mental function, then our inherited scientific map of the mind is inside out. Indeed, the absence of emotion pervades modern scientific models of the mind. In the most popular mental metaphors of social science, mind as reflex, from behaviorism, explicitly omits emotion, and mind as computer, from cognitivism, all but ignores it. Even when emotion appears in later theories, it's usually an afterthought, an epiphenomenal reaction to something that has already happened. But over the past decade, the rising field of affective science has revealed that emotions can precede and motivate thought and behavior. Emerging physiological, behavioral, and neuroimaging evidence suggests that emotions are proactive as well as reactive. Emotional signals from the brain now yield predictions about choice and mental health symptoms and may soon guide scientists to specific circuits that confer more precise control over thought and behavior. Thus, the price of continuing to ignore emotion's centrality to mental function could be substantial. By assuming the mind is like a bundle of reflexes, a computer program, or even a self-interested rational actor, we may miss out on significant opportunities to predict and control behavior, both in individuals and groups. We should stop relegating emotion to the periphery and move it to the center where it belongs.